Talk given Saturday, 17th November, 1973. 3 days ago, there was a royal wedding. How do we react to such an event? What are the thoughts and feelings aroused in us as we see such an event on TV or in the streets or hear people talking about it or the news and reports on the radio or the descriptions in the papers and particularly the comments of the folk, the people of the country? How do we respond to it all? Does it make us happy or excited? Does it raise up memories, perhaps sadness at recalling our own frustrations, if any? Is there jealousy? A royal wedding in Westminster Abbey with all that ceremony and pomp and all the rest of it? Or is there angry criticism? What a waste of public money and so forth. Are we really mindful of such things as they arise in our own consciousness? Or perhaps was there some feeling of nostalgia, a sentimental feeling, or a condescending feeling? Ah, well, poor dears, they look very happy now, but we, the wise ones, know. At least we are very indulgent to ourselves in calling ourselves wise ones and in presuming that we know. What is it that rises up in us? Or is there a furtive tear that rolls down one's cheek, or a lump in one's throat, and a catch in one's voice as one talks about it? See, these questions are not asked out of curiosity. There is something very deep involved in it. We associate the idea of marriage with fulfillment and happiness. Fundamentally and essentially, we are perfectly right in such association. Because marriage in its reality is the concretest expression of that transcendental, timeless conjugation, because of which the entire universal process comes into being and continues to be. We do not know that process. The great mass of people throughout the world today and in all the ages that have gone past are completely unaware of it. And those who have had some sort of glimpse of it, some sort of deep chord in their hearts which responds to that, do not know the whole of it, naturally. But we can say categorically that we are not wrong in what we feel about marriage. If we feel rightly, that is. But unfortunately, we, being what we are, ignorant, incapable, clumsy, self-oriented, desirous of sensation and pleasure, define marriage and fulfillment in our miserable terms. We have a false picture of it. And we spend our lives trying to fit reality into our false pictures. What is important for us, who are seriously concerned with the religious life, the holy life, is to understand how and why we go wrong, and therefore remain producers of ill, of frustration, of unhappiness, and so forth. Instead of letting life come to full fruition through us. Let us look into this carefully. Let us investigate this question of mindfulness, being awake to the situation, to the fact which is present here now. If we observe the process in our minds whilst we are awake, we will notice that the different sense impressions which we have received in our lifetime and through which we have developed our tastes, our preferences, and so on, all keep emerging into consciousness and intruding upon complete attention to the immediate now. Take, for example, the tune that obsesses one. I've got that tune on my brain, as we say. Or some particular event, the shape of that event of the past keeps obtruding into consciousness. Or some sort of memory, or some sort of fantasy. And you will notice that all of these are associated with the sense impressions which we have received, as well as our uncontrolled, uninhibited reactions to those impressions. These reactions take place without our being able to stop them or consider their possibility beforehand. And you will find that the impressions which have a tendency to come again and again are those which gave us pleasure, and sometimes those which have caused us pain, and therefore produce a reaction of hate, of aversion to them. The conscious mind is a constant battleground of these opposing forces. The psyche is a perpetual turmoil. You will also notice that when the psyche is quiet and at peace, as we think, and not unjustifiably, it is due to the fact, usually, that the conditions around us are favorable enough to allow that atmosphere of peace to pervade us. Some little demon out of the depths of the subconscious has not risen up and caused trouble in the conscious mind. Then we are at peace, and we say, oh, how nice it is, quiet and lovely and beautiful. But it lasts a very short time, generally. And then it disappears. And once again, the whole turmoil starts up. Have we ever inquired, if we have practiced mindfulness at all, if we do practice it at all, have we ever inquired how and why it is that this goes on? It is fundamentally due to our particular desires. Desire is general. Every human being in the world has desire in him, desire energy at work. But our particular desires are shaped by, first and foremost, by our own constitution, particularly the brain and the nervous system and the ductless glands. They sort of lay down a blueprint of the general tendencies, the general forms in which desire will manifest in oneself. Then again, our desire, the form of our desire, is determined by our conditioning, our upbringing, our education, our surroundings, our experience. And all this desire energy clamors for expression. It wants to move our lives, determine the shape of our lives. And it is always centered round the I. Desire is so dominant that it enslaves intellect. The intellect is prevented from seeing truly, seeing the fact as it is. We are prevented from dispassionate, scientific observation, which would imply clarity of mind. And therefore, this state of turmoil continuously characterizes the psyche in the waking state, particularly in the waking state. Now, when we practice mindfulness, or we attempt to practice mindfulness, all this interferes with pure mindfulness. Our mindfulness is never pure. It cannot be pure as long as these subtle and extremely strong forces in the psyche, in the unconscious part of the mind, are at play. We get deceived that we are practicing mindfulness. We are up to a point, of course. We have taken at least one step that we have embarked upon the practice of mindfulness. That at least is one step. But we are under an extraordinary delusion if we think that we have the capacity to be mindful. To be truly mindful, to be purely mindful. You see, this delusion in the religia with respect to the practice of mindfulness, watchfulness, or as the Christian mystics call it, self-recollectedness, this delusion is the exact counterpart of the ordinary man in the world who says, oh, let me look at this and let me look into it. He assumes that he is capable of looking with clear sight into it, free of all kinds of illusions, preconceptions and assumptions associated with it. Even the scientist, who is supposed to be capable of dispassionate, objective observation, does not exercise such dispassionateness and objectivity as he thinks he does. Therefore, in this practice of mindfulness, we must know, at least intellectually, that these are the obstructive forces against pure mindfulness at work. Now, if there is the really serious concern with living the religious life, one will not practice this superficial type of mindfulness and be content with it. This is the type of mindfulness that one practices 10, 20, 50, 100 years and says at the end of it, well, I'm no forerunner than I was when I started. Well, of course not. If I choose to go round and round in circles in the mud, I never get out of the mud, obviously. I'm just going round and round in circles in it. This is where the real determination part comes in. Not that rigid, obstinate feeling that I'm going to achieve this. Not that. That is childish and immature. But the determination, this something from within, which, because of the seriousness of the whole business, feels and experiences the right sort of drive. Therefore, that one must be mindful in the pure sense. Now, this determination is not my will. This is the important point to remember. This is something which is the gift of transcendence, which is the gift of God. It is in us. Everything godlike is within us. We have the potentiality of it all within us. So this determination is like the will of God. And the will of God is not a particularized desire which is shaped by the conditioning that God undergoes. This is the point. Something quite different. It is what the Rig Veda called Ritta, the eternal order of things which brings everything to right fulfillment. It is inherent in us, just as it is inherent in the whole universal process. And it is natural, therefore. It is of nature. If you like to so regard it is the supernature part of nature. The part which brings to perfection and real fulfillment. It is this sort of determination that we have to have. Which means, therefore, that if it is quite unconcerned with my will, which is merely my immature desire, then it will be in line with this transcendent power of Ritta, the eternal order of things which is inherent in the total life process. This is very, very important. If and when that can happen, we discover that our self-orientation begins to dissolve. We get turned inside out. And when this inside out, or this inside outing takes place, then life itself is in control, in command. And remember that life, eternal life, exercises no compulsion anywhere. Why does it not exercise compulsion? Because the activity, the action of eternal life is in terms of eternity and not of time. And if it is in terms of eternity, it is not seeking a particular result. It is not preconceiving a fruition and a fulfillment. It just lives in its own fullness and beauty comes into being. Fruition, perfection, just naturally comes into being. It is because we preconceive beauty that we succeed in smudging the beautiful. Because beauty is infinite. It won't stand any constriction. So now, life does not compel because it functions in terms of eternity. Now, we have to get aware in the deep sense of these things. First, of course, one hears the words or reads them, the intellect stirs. An impression is made on the brain and intellect stirs. Inevitably, it creates a thought form. But remember that the thought form is like a cloud. It is ephemeral. Don't try to fossilize the cloud. Otherwise, we are everlastingly in the clouds. All right. Intellect creates the thought form. Let that thought form just be the passing means which enables us to let this mystery, this marvel, this unknown come to fruition. And it'll come to fruition always in terms of ephemeral forms. That cannot be avoided. That is the nature of the becoming process. But when we do that, when we let life come to fruition of its own accord, then we have ceased to obstruct that which holds within itself this transcendent power of Ritta, the eternal order of things. To use a theistic term, the will of God. If you look at non-theistic presentations of religious truth, you will find the Buddha saying, summon up chanda, summon up virya, chanda, desire, will, in the sense of will, determination, virya, energy, strength. But this will is not my will. It is the universal will allowed to come function freely through non-obstruction by my will. This is the important point. Summon up strength, virya. That does not mean squander your life energies. To draw upon your capital and have a bank balance in the red. No, no, no. The virya, the strength which is summoned, is not my strength, but that infinite resilience which characterizes the strength of the transcendent, and that resilience functions through you, the person. The non-resistance to the Supreme, that resilience means. If such factors are present, then the mindfulness is becoming pure. It gets purer and purer. Now, when that mindfulness becomes purer and purer, you will notice that the conscious mind ceases to be obsessed by the tune which is on your brain. It ceases to be troubled by the uprising of memories which are unpleasant, or memories which are pleasant. Because that is just indulgence, emotional indulgence, wallowing in your feelings. Self-pity and all the rest of it because one has suffered, or self-exaltation and all such immaturities because we think that, oh, we did some good in the past. I never did any good in the past. The good came into being. Remember Jesus' words? Why callest thou me good? Only God is good. So all that will cease as far as the conscious life is concerned. The memory of tastes, of touches, of events which one enjoyed, or the events from which one suffered. Consider for a moment how such a great part of our suffering now is due to the fact that we hark back to the past and say, if only my parents or my teacher or my friend or the people around or the laws of the land or whatever it was, you see, if that hadn't been there, and see the way we torment ourselves emotionally, recalling all that and pointing the finger of blame to it. Of course it happened. Yes, it happened. It was a fact. But let the dead lie dead. Don't try to resuscitate the dead. This dead is the really deadly dead. It is in one's memory. It is not a reality in terms of fact. Because the whole fact of the past has undergone transformation continuously through time and is here now, alive. And this is what I have to deal with. And when my mindfulness is pure mindfulness, I am dealing with it. And I'm dealing with it totally undesirously. I'm not wishing that the shape of it shall be changed into this or that particular shape, because that is just my folly once again imposing itself upon the perfection of life. So I'm being mindful in the right way. And when I'm mindful in the right way, as we have already tried to see, all these absurd obstructions and miseries that we go through are out. How are we conscious then? We are conscious as the gods are conscious. I'm speaking metaphorically, but you'll understand. We are completely in tune with the totality of the now, the here now, without obstructing it. And in that non-obstructiveness, we are in the state of poise and inward harmony. And in that state of poise and inward harmony, transcendent energies function freely through one's own living psychophysical organism in the here and the now and bring about their own effect. I don't know what, but they bring about their own effect in the entire surrounding. This is how the work of transmutation, this activity of the spiritual energy whose nature we don't know, takes place. The man of the world will say, good gracious me, have you any evidence at all for these airy-fairy flights of your fancy? And I will say to him, I have no evidence whatsoever, and I'm not interested in producing any evidence for you. If you are interested, if something within you, within the depths of you, can stir in response to transcendent reality, you investigate. That's your business, not mine. Because you are free. It's not for me to try and convince you of transcendent reality, of transcendence. Everyone who tries to prove the existence of God, for example, is being just a bit childish and very often downright foolish. So you see, in pure mindfulness, in that state of poise and equanimity within, these transcendent energies, which, to use the Sanskrit term, are the akashic energies, the energies of what I, for example, call pure mind, which is shapeless, formless, indescribable, inconceivable. It is these akashic energies which now play through you. And you will find one of the effects of this is that you will have an extraordinary absorptive power with respect to whatsoever comes upon you. An absorptive power. And you remain poised. I don't say you remain unhurt. You can be hurt. Because the organism has its limitations. The body as well as the psyche. The whole psychophysical organism has its limitations. You can be hurt. But in your inner consciousness, you remain poised. You remain at peace, in harmony. You are fulfilling the purpose of your existence. To be a focus point for the actual manifestation in the world of things and affairs of these transcendent energies. This is the great purpose of human existence. People ask, what is the purpose of my existence here? Has life any purpose? No purpose which I can define. No purpose which is subject to the constraints of my petty little criteria or judgments or evaluations. But the divine purposefulness comes to fruition. You might ask me, what makes you say a thing like that? When one is in such states, there is an extraordinary peace, a stillness and a silence, which is not the mere opposite of turmoil or noise, but completely subsumes all turmoil and noise. Itself remaining utterly peaceful. This state is the supremely absorptive state of consciousness. And in as long as it lasts in time, it transmutes all that comes into it. It is also the state in which you make real, you realize infinite resilience, which is omnipotence. You think of it. You can work out logically, intellectually. If something is infinitely resilient, it cannot be destroyed, it cannot be hurt. It's infinitely resilient. twist it this way, that way, bang it, hammer it, atomize it if you can. It's infinitely resilient. And that's that. I am God. I cannot die. I cannot be snuffed out. That's that. It's as simple as that. And as extraordinary and incredible as that. You see, therefore, something of the meaning of pure mindfulness. This freedom from the intrusion of all the gathered sense impressions of our life. A freedom which enables the mind to be itself in its own rights. Pure mind, empty in the true sense, transparent, utterly transparent, offering no hindrance whatsoever to transcendent life and energy. This is the state of the yogi. You will appreciate at once why, therefore, once again, I repeat for the 1,000th time, I think, in these years, the absolute basis, purity. No nonsense about it. Absolute, straightforward basis of purity. All the simple moralities, naturally fulfilled now. One doesn't have to strive and struggle for them. There is that basis. There is the clarity of the mind, which sees the fact as it is, which is fully aware of all the responses or the mere reactions, the unstoppable reactions which come up, and is aware that they are just that and what they are, and is therefore unmoved by them. And therefore, the burden of an unnecessary heap of sorrow falls off from one. And one remains poised. And in that state, one is truly man, truly human, the Son of Man who is identical with the Son of God. The Manasaputra, we have the same terms in Sanskrit, you know. I'm using these Christian phrases simply because you're acquainted with them. We have the Manasaputra, who is the Brahmaputra, the son of mind. Man means mind, essentially. The son of man, who is the son of God. The son of mind, who is the son of that creative power of the universe. That creative pulse. So you see, why this mindfulness is the linchpin of the whole of the spiritual discipline. And remember that religious discipline means fundamentally learning by growing. It emerges from within. It is not conforming or trying to conform to what one is told, because that is mechanical. The learning by growing is alive. Are we concerned with abundant life or with producing another machine, a source of pollution on the earth? So you see, this mindfulness is really the linchpin of this growing by learning. Therefore, the mind comes to maturity in each one of us, and the whole of the psyche becomes purified, utterly purified. And this purity of the psyche is here and now, whilst we are alive, whilst the psychophysical organism is alive, is a real meaning of the term immortal soul. Not something which merely continues in time as a changeless, identifiable entity, not a bit of it. Something which undergoes transformation perpetually, but which is deathless for the simple reason that it is perpetually in tune, in rhythm with Ritta, this eternal order of things. This transcendent life, which is beyond all the petty definitions by one's own mind, and so forth. Jesus said, watch and pray. And the Buddha said, samasati, perfect mindfulness, and samasamadhi, perfect communion. And in the communion, remember, there is no I obtruding upon the state of unity, that is, disrupting or attempting to disrupt the state of unity. Amongst Christian mystics, for instance, you will find Ruysbroeck has given some of the most marvelous little statements about this unity, which is the absolute unity, where the self does not impinge upon the total wholeness or holiness of reality. And then, if that is the case, what will one find for oneself? And this is a real fact. What one realizes is indeed the royal wedding. This timeless, transcendent conjugation, which is the creative pulse of the universe itself. Your entire consciousness is subsumed in that creative pulse. All the time. There is no impurity within one's awareness. It is the state of the royal wedding. And here on earth, we associate wedding with happiness. And it is that royal wedding which is the absolute happiness.